Welcome to the Issue Biz Podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. A historic week we will not soon forget. Donald Trump winning the election, winning all of the battleground states, and setting himself up to become the 47th president of the United States. We got some big guns this week to discuss all of this. With us, Katie Porter, Democratic Congress member from Irvine, joining our panel. With a lot to say. Peter Hamby of Puck News and Snapchat, who's been with us, was with us last week, kind of saw a lot of this coming. He shares his perspective. A little later, we'll hear from John Cobalt, who also saw this coming 4 years ago on our show. He's from KFI. And also with us, Pete Aguilar, the chair of the House Democrats, with the preview of what's to come for the House Democrats going forward. So really interesting perspectives, and everybody went long for the TV version, but this is the better version, which is the everything from everyone, and it is worth listening to. So let's start with Peter and with the Congresswoman, but first, here is Donald Trump.
This was, I believe, the greatest political movement of all time.
Trump dominates and Kamala Harris loses ground, and the country will be feeling the impact of this week for decades to come. Great to have both of you here. Thanks for being here. Congresswoman, let's start with you. What happened? Why did Trump win?
Well, I think there's probably a lot of things going on. I would remind people at the start of this that while Trump won the presidency, Democrats actually fared pretty well in a lot of ways this election cycle. We won in a lot of states that Trump won, right? North Carolina, Wisconsin, where we got majorities in the legislature. And the House, I think, is still potentially on a path to Democratic control. So I don't think this is a mandate. I think that Democrats need to continue to fight for the American people, to fight for the issues that matter most to people. And I think in this next immediate aftermath, we need to avoid the blame and instead talk about and be responsive to our constituents. So on election night, I went to pick up my daughter from water polo practice, and she's 12, and she got in the car and she was crying. And I said, did someone punch you? Like, water polo is a rough sport. Yeah. I was like, did someone hit you? Did the coach yell at you? What happened? And she said, Mom, Trump won. Trump's going to win. And what if I get raped and I need to have an abortion? This is from a 12-year-old, my 12-year-old daughter. Mm. And so it was really a reminder of how scary this time is for people and how important it is for Democrats to have strategies, both at the state level and the federal level, to make sure that we can continue to protect people's rights.
But let me push back a second on the concept that this wasn't sort of a mandate. I mean, he won every single swing state, and he gained in almost every single county in the country, gaining in California.
Well, I think
Orange County.
Yeah. I mean, I think gaining is really different than saying, like, everybody agrees, which is how I think about a mandate.
Okay. So I mean, it's not 1980. It's not 1984.
That's right.
Right.
So, look, I think it's important for us to think about what were the issues and what were the voters that moved toward him. Clearly, Americans feel anxious about economic opportunity. They feel anxious about where our economy is in the world. Younger voters in particular, I think, worry about, are they going to be able to afford housing? Are they going to be able to afford to start an economy? What will AI mean for those jobs? And I do think Vice President Harris had a good message on those things. But Trump ran a very chaotic, noisy campaign. And I think to the extent it was just hard for that message to penetrate.
And Peter, you spent a lot of time talking to young voters all around the country. And last week on our show, you talked about what they said to you. Here's some of that.
Even the Kamala Harris voters open to the idea of Donald Trump a little bit because it might make their pocketbooks a little healthier.
How do you read what happened?
I mean, Congresswoman Porter's right on the young people talking about the economic anxieties they have. In college students I was talking to, only a third of Americans have a college degree. They're not emblematic of all young people. Graduating into a, you know, world or just their community where rent is higher. I heard the grocery thing, the gas thing, the prices thing over and over again, as I said there, even from young women of color who were going to vote for Kamala Harris, but they were worried about it. And so, you know, hindsight's 2020, but looking back on those interviews, there were all some clues in there. I think big picture, I think Kamala Harris probably ran the best campaign she could under incredibly rare, unprecedented circumstances. The drag of Joe Biden being very unpopular was clear. Also, you know, smarter people than I have stepped back. Pretty much every incumbent government in the entire world has been wiped out in the post-COVID world. Prices everywhere. They could be a very right-leaning government in India. It could be Biden's administration here and Kamala Harris. Like, everyone just is feeling the blowback of prices. That downward pressure really made people anxious. And I also think, you know, one thing I learned out on the road too is the abortion issue is a little more complicated than people think. Like, once you get into the second trimester, there's some mixed feelings about it in polling. Some people I talked to, young Kamala Harris voters even, you know, were, I wouldn't say they were sympathetic to Donald Trump, but the idea that abortion could be back in the states, maybe Donald Trump moderated on that a little bit. But look, that doesn't mean there aren't real world consequences to the abortion restrictions that are pretty drastic in many, many states. But the economy was the prevailing issue overall, and that's what won it for.
And the truth on the inflation issue is that America has actually done better than most of the rest of the world. But that is a tough message for people to understand. You're not comparing your prices to what somebody's paying in the UK.
Right.
You're comparing your prices to what you paid
also,
a year ago.
You're also not looking at, like, you know, data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics when you go to the gas station or the grocery
store. You're standing in front of the two boxes of cereal, and you're saying, I am not. Like, I've told my son, Paul, we are not buying $7 Apple Jacks. Like, they're just not that good. Like, we're not putting those in the cart. Like, go find some generic cereal, the generic Cheerios, and put them in. And so I think people experience that in a very personal way. And I think for Democrats, it's not that they have strong economic policy. I have grave concerns about, as does every economist in the world, about what Donald Trump's proposed policies will mean for our economy. But I think Democrats' struggle is, how do you connect those policies to those very concrete moments in people's lives, like standing at the grocery store.
And there's a strong argument that tariffs is going to make everything more expensive, but the Democrats were not able to effectively communicate that message.
Joe Biden has never been the world's greatest communicator, but he hasn't communicated what he did for the economy. Bernie Sanders put out a statement the other day saying the Democratic Party forgot about the middle class.
Let's put that up on the screen right now. This is what Bernie Sanders had to say, and it's quite something. Basically saying here, it should come as no great surprise that a Democratic Party, which has abandoned working class people, would find that the working class has abandoned them.
So, look, Joe Biden was the first president to walk a picket line. When I was traveling through Michigan and Pennsylvania a couple weeks ago, like, you would see signs from, you know, the Infrastructure Act, like, this highway brought to you by, he did the Donald Trump thing, Joe Biden. He signed his name on these billboards that were all over the place, but people didn't understand that. There's also the question of culture. You know, if when Bernie Sanders is talking about the working class, like, the Democratic Party used to be the party of workers, and the Republican Party was the party of management.
Country club.
It's kind of been flipped on its head a little bit. And Trump has astutely used culture as a way in with white working class voters, but also non-white working class voters. And we obviously saw that in exit polls, which are flawed and will be revised, and we'll see. But it's very clear that within that, at least, like, Latinos decisively moved in Trump's direction.
Do you think Senator Sanders is right?
Well, look, I think Democrats have better policies for working class people. And we've seen that. We've seen that in what Trump did with his tax bill last time he was president, which was huge giveaways to the ultra wealthy and really punished middle class and working class voters with his tax policy. The idea that Donald Trump is some kind of actually has experience with what it's like to be a working American is laughable. But I think that doesn't mean that Democrats don't have work to do in how they communicate policy. And one of the things I've talked a lot about, Alex, is, you know, being a mom of young kids in Congress, what it's like to live on your congressional salary. What can we do to make it easier to elect young people, working class people? And you saw my colleague, Marie Glusenkamp-Perez, who won a very tough race in Washington. I've won again and again in Orange County, where Donald Trump is currently leading. And it's because I think there is a hunger for us to have a government that is representative. And so I think Democrats do need to think about, what are we doing with our policies, the establishment or the status quo, that is holding back candidates who have that ability to connect. And I think that's a legitimate thing for us to be asking ourselves.
It is amazing if you think about it. Donald Trump, who lives in literally a golden tower in a country club and flies around on a private jet, has this ability to connect with working class people and make them feel heard by him.
It's a real conundrum, because if you look at the battleground states, and there were real campaign effects in the swing states, Kamala Harris did, like, 2.4 points better or something than in the non-swing states. So the campaign did have a positive effect for her. She got more raw votes in those battleground states, most of them, except for Pennsylvania, than Joe Biden did. But Donald Trump got even more than that. And so I'm curious to hear from you on this, actually, because in 2017, like you were elected in 2018, we had the resistance. There was this, like, uprising and this anger in the middle and on the left against Donald Trump. This time, how do Democrats respond to possibly a popular vote victory, the fact that Donald Trump got more votes than Kamala Harris, who got more votes than Joe Biden? It's just a very fascinating entanglement. It's culture, it's economics, and it's how Democrats communicate what they do. I mean, Marie Gluzenkamp-Perez is a good example. She did an interview in the New York Times on Friday where she talked a lot about just casework. Like, I do constituent services. Yeah. Like, someone has a tax issue, I'm going in on that.
Right.
And, like, that's hard to extrapolate at the national level where cultural issues are very important. Blueprint, the last thing I'll say, which is a Democratic polling firm, they put out a lot of messaging advice this cycle. They came out with a poll Friday that said the number one reason swing voters think Kamala Harris lost is because she was perceived as too liberal on cultural issues and social issues, some of the things that she took positions on back in 2019 that she wasn't able to get away from.
I think Peter brings up an interesting question for you. This idea of where does the quote-unquote resistance go from here? Because we saw the big protests and the pussy hats and everything in the streets, and we haven't seen that this week. It seems like there was more of a shrug almost. What is the effective way for Democrats to resist Donald Trump and win elections going forward?
Well, I think there's a lot of work that will be done at the local and state level, and we've seen some of that already. We saw Governor Newsom saying he's going to have a special session. We know that Attorney General Bonta has and will continue to try to defend people's rights. I think the fact that we saw people elect Democratic governors in places like North Carolina, majority legislatures in places like Wisconsin, it means that people think Democrats actually, in the policies that are closest to their lives, actually do a really, really good job. Whether they're trusting us or connecting with us on these high, sort of distant cultural issues, I think is a different question. I will say, and you remember this from my Senate campaign, I very, very much ran on an economic message about corruption, about lobbying, about special interests. And I think for sort of the resistance, for lack of a better term, they really feed off hearing about democracy and the Constitution and that kind of stuff. For most swing voters, that's not where it's at.
Yep.
And if you're going to talk about, I do think Donald Trump's an existential threat to our democracy. And the fact that that's true, and they got so much feedback from within Democratic circles about it, meant that we weren't always consistently, for the last 2 years, I think Kamala Harris actually did an excellent job of not doing this, but I think kind of across the Democratic ecosystem. So I think for people, it's going to be about really looking at who are my neighbors? Who lives in America? What are the challenges? And Democrats need to understand what it is like to not own a house today and face the prospects of never being able to own one.
The postmortems of this campaign there will be many. But one question that will be debated going forward is Kamala Harris closing on democracy, sort of issues that might sound
fascism,
academic to certain voters, and getting away from economic issues and middle-class populism.
And I wonder how many people could even define the word fascism, if that's what you're running on.
I didn't hear it come up, I will say, when I was talking to students at commuter schools in Ohio and Pennsylvania and North Carolina. Not that they don't know what fascism means, it's just that the first thing on the tip of their tongue was either the economy and then a bunch of other issues, but democracy and fascism rarely came up.
One of the big questions going forward is there going to be a Democratic House or not? This week, I spoke with Pete Aguilar, who's the chair of the House Democrats. He's the congressman from the Inland Empire. Here's some of what he said about what's ahead.
It would be better if we were in the majority, and so that's what we're working on right now.
Based off of what you're seeing, and you know this stuff better than just about anyone, are you tracking right now like a 1 or 2 seat difference? What do you think it's going to ultimately come down to?
You know, the weather forecast is tight. That's what it is. Look, we're not in a position to say what the majority will be, but we are in a position to say the majority is not certain.
Congresswoman, I know there were a lot of people that were wishing that you were returning to Congress. Your district itself, Dave Min running to replace you, you feel good about that one?
I do. I think Democrat Dave Min is going to win the race over Republican Scott Baugh, who I beat last time. And look, like, I know this better than anyone. I spent 9 days in 2018 losing before I was winning and then went on to serve in Congress. Even in last election cycle, 2022, it took me 6 days to have the race called. This is part of how California voting works. And so I think we're going to see in the next day or two, tonight, tomorrow, and into next week, I think we will pick up a few more seats in California, and that will bring us very, very close to a Democratic majority. I don't know if we get there, as I agree with Congressman Aguilar, the weather forecast is tight.
Yeah, and a lot of people watch this are going to be like, why does it take so much longer in California than Florida? Florida gets it. And really, it is a feature, not a bug. Can you explain why California has made this decision to do it this way? Because it is a decision.
Yep. It's not just California. It's actually most of the West Coast. So Washington, Oregon, Arizona, increasingly. We have decided that we want to give people the entirety of Election Day to cast their ballot and to be able to cast their ballot on Election Day in the way that works best for them, which means we can't count the ballots at 8 o'clock because they're still being poked into the drop box at 7:59. People are still postmarking them and they're on mail trucks and they're coming in. So look, the research is really clear. When you have this kind of system, you allow more people to participate in our democracy. You have a more representative democracy. It's procrastinators, I mean, we all know them. Okay. I'm not one, but there are a lot of them out there. And they should have just as much a right to be heard in the election as others. So it does take a few more days, but it's a very, very good election system. And it allows people who maybe can't get time off work to drop it off at 8 o'clock, who maybe can't stand in line for 3 and 4 hours, like we saw in my congressional district this cycle. The lines at University of California, Irvine were 4 and 5 hours long at times. So it does permit people to be able to vote in the way that's best for them.
So we're allowing for people to mail in ballots, which have to come in. We're doing signature verification on all the mail in ballots, which takes time. If there's an error on the signature verification, we give people time to fix it so that they make sure that their ballot is counted, which is why it takes a lot longer. And we have seen voter participation go way up because of this. In 2020, we were at over 70% voter registration, or voter participation, which was the highest that we saw since 1952.
I really like this proud Californian vibe coming from you, because I really do think that we ought to be asking ourselves, in some of these states where it's gotten more difficult to vote over the last 4 years, what is the cost of that? So we are seeing an electorate in some of these states where, yes, it swung for Donald Trump, and I think there's something real there, but we also had a lot of states where it became more difficult to vote and people were purged from the rolls, and the system of voting is
my home state of Virginia.
Yeah. Yeah. I am a proud Californian.
Me too.
Yeah, we know.
Our thanks to them. More now with Peter Hamby and the Congresswoman. But let's start with an update on Governor Newsom. Governor Gavin Newsom in Ventura County this week, meeting with rescue crews at the Mountain Fire on the same day that he called for a special session to preemptively set aside money to fight the Trump administration. I talked with Jesse Gabriel, the chair of the Budget Committee, about that.
Hopefully we will not be in a position where we don't have to file a lot of these lawsuits. This is to be ready in the case that they break the law, that they violate the U.S. Constitution, that they are doing things that are unlawful or unconstitutional, and we're not going to get caught flat-footed.
Let's talk more with our panel right now, Katie Porter and Peter Hamby. Peter, there are some people that see what the governor is doing as just a step to running for president, and that it's a stunt and that it's unnecessary. What say you?
I was going to say that a lot of people are going to perceive it as a stunt, that he's posturing for the next presidential election, that Kamala Harris losing opens the door to Gavin Newsom. The flip side of that is Gavin Newsom is actually a very bright, intelligent person who reads all the language and the laws. And two, let's acknowledge we do live in a country where we have red states and blue states. And leadership in California very much has the right to huddle after what is likely to be a very ahistorical, unprecedented second Trump term and figure out what can we do for our people here in California. Remember, after Trump withdrew from the Paris Climate Accords, Mayor Garcetti here, like a bunch of Democratic governors, they got together on their own. And they're like, how can we keep fighting this even if there's no larger framework? So I think Governor Newsom's absolutely making the right move for his party and, you know, his state.
I know you've publicly agreed with that.
I absolutely agree with that. And I think, look, there are a lot of people who Trump made clear are going to be kind of in his line of sight, both people who maybe are, you know, are DACA students, you know, people who are worried about abortion, people who are trans. Like, there are a lot of people who are having a lot of anxiety. It's not just I disagree. It's actually we had a presidential candidate who said, I'm going to come and I'm going to go get them. I'm going to go harm them. I'm going to go take away things from them. And so I think it's absolutely appropriate. Look, we have a federalist system. We are the, as Gavin said in his tweet, I should call him Governor Newsom, but as Governor Newsom said in his tweet, we are the United States of America. And it's, I agree with Peter. It's appropriate for states to take
action. And also
action.
Every, by the way, like it or not, how many Republican attorneys general filed lawsuits against the Biden administration the whole time? Like, if a Republican governor did the same thing, you know, it, like, they would also say this is like states' rights. You know,
that's it's part of the checks and it's part of the checks and balances. So when we talk, there's been so much talk about what can we do at the federal level to potentially check Donald Trump, and I, you know, I think winning the House is one of some things. And I was certainly part of that check in 2018. But the other is to recognize that our states and even our localities do have the ability to curb some of that excess or to prevent some of that harm.
We just got some of the law professor, Katie Porter, there for a second. So let's look into the future now. Kamala Harris was the first Democratic presidential nominee ever from California, somebody that you know well, used to work for. What do you think's next for her? Do you think she's going to run for governor?
Well, I hope some rest is next for her. I have a little bit of a taste of how tiring a campaign is. But look, this is somebody who truly has spent her entire career in government service, in public service, and has continued to seek out new opportunities pretty aggressively. So I can't say exactly what that's going to look like for her, but I would be surprised if this is the last we've seen of her willingness to serve the American people and Californians in particular.
What about governor?
I don't know what she's thinking. Yeah. I don't know what all, I mean, we have a big race is coming up in 2026, and I do think it's not just our governor's race, but we have all, you know, all of the constitutional officers really coming up in 2026.
She's so young, and she's so talented. Like, she doesn't have to run for governor now. She can pull a Jerry Brown and run in 30 years.
That is true. He was governor at 36 and at 80. But there, of course, are a lot of people that are wondering if you are going to run for governor. So what are you thinking?
I am still thinking, I think is the answer. So I feel a little bit like I think Kamala does. Like, I care about these issues, and particularly these economic issues. The cost of housing was the sort of marquee thing in my Senate campaign, the thing I talked the most about. I'm so glad to see Democrats finally beginning to engage on what has been a big problem. And so I don't know exactly what that's going to look like. I'm going back to law teaching in the spring. I'm you know, looking forward to whiteboarding some law students in the meantime, and then we'll see where it goes from there. But look, California has challenges. We also have so many opportunities. And I think, particularly with Donald Trump as president, having that strong state leadership, someone really tough who's willing to stand up to Donald Trump, as Gavin has been, is going to be important.
So do you have a timeline on when you might make that decision?
I do not.
Okay. And Peter, are you running for governor?
I just know I do not want to take your law school class. That would scare the F out of me.
No, it's my bark is worse than my bite.
Okay. Well, it is great to see you both. Thank you for your insight. John Cobalt is with us next, and he's got a different take on the governor and some of that. Our thanks to Peter Hamby and Katie Porter. Now to a segment with John Cobalt from KFI, starting with a throwback from the past. This is a look at the issue is from 4 years ago exactly, the week Joe Biden defeated Donald Trump to win the presidency. With us, you see Carla Marinucci, Brian Goldsmith, and KFI's John Cobalt. Listen to what John predicted.
May have signed up now for 8 years of Trump because he's probably going to run again, and his campaign will start in 2 years. He'll agitate from now until 2022, then he starts a campaign, and then if he wins, he'll be around until 2028. So instead of getting it over with quickly in 4 years, now there might be 8 more years of Trump in the media every day.
Well, you got it exactly right. So much so, we wanted to bring you back to gloat.
I am Nostradamus.
Yeah.
I will tell you your future.
Yeah. So, I mean, how did this happen? I guess you saw it all coming.
Well, yeah. What I said that night, because I was looking at a longer version of the clip, is he had 70 million votes, which was the highest in history next to Joe Biden, same election. 70 million votes, nobody's going to quit that game. I mean, you know, plus, you know, he'd already started talking about that he got screwed in the count. So it was I said he's going to agitate for 2 years. Boy, did he agitate. I mean, that was before Insurrection Day.
Right.
So he's not, and you know, the thing about him is, I compare him to probably what color television must have been like. When people saw color TV, you couldn't go back to black and white. When people heard the Beatles, you couldn't go back to listening to Bobby Rydell. You had somebody who is so different and so explosive, it makes all the other politicians look washed out and faded. Mm. And it's hard to go back and look at somebody, let's say Ron DeSantis, who ordinarily would be, you know, a strong candidate.
Probably would have been the nominee.
But up against Donald Trump, he disappears into the wall. It's like wallpaper. And that's the problem. As long as he's on stage, he's very difficult to beat.
How do you think he did it? I mean, why do you think he won?
I saw two numbers. I saw a CNN poll. 75% of the public said, my financial situation is worse. I saw a CBS poll where 62% of the country wants mass deportations immediately. Mm. That's mostly what he talked about. And all the rest was just noise that I don't think most of the public paid attention to. Everybody was angry about inflation.
Yeah.
And that was a tough issue because you can't reverse inflation. You know, a lot of the journalists, economists said, well, you know, it's now down to 2.8%. No. For grocery bills, it was 30% cumulative. Another 2.8%, now you're up to 33%, and so on. And people are reminded of that every day.
Every day.
And they don't have enough money.
And people aren't necessarily watching or listening to politics every day.
No.
But they got to go grocery shopping every week. They see the gas prices every day as they drive by. And even if you're not that into this stuff, you're living that. You interviewed Trump not that long ago. Here's a clip of how he described that interview.
Are you nervous at all in these huge crowds considering what's happened?
Nervous is not a good word, but, you know, I watch out. But, you know, it is what it is. Look, it's a dangerous business. Being president is a dangerous business.
That's one of the things he said. He also said to you that talking to you was like therapy.
It's a psychiatrist.
You're like a psychiatrist for him. What, after talking to him, experiencing him, how did that sort of change your view of him?
Talking to him made me realize one of his gifts is he really can connect with people easily. When he gets comfortable, I remember that the first line or two, he was a little tentative. And when he realized I wasn't going to turn this into a mud wrestling match, which many interviewers do, he started relaxing and being Donald Trump the entertainer, Donald Trump the guy at the bar. And that's why I enjoyed the interview. It showed another side of him. Mm-hmm. There were plenty of people who were doing the combative journalism, which needs to be done. But, you know, that space was pretty crowded. So I went to another space and said, okay, he's relaxed, he's being funny, and people should know that too. And because that's a huge part of his appeal.
You know, the media really got a lot of this wrong. The pollsters got it wrong,
yeah,
saying it was a 50-50 split. It really wasn't a 50-50 split. He dominated.
No.
He won every single swing state, which were supposed to be so neck and neck.
He went up in 48 out of the 50 states.
Yeah, and the Democrats clearly have a messaging problem around the country. Where do they go from here?
They got to get off all the woke stuff. They've got to retire all the weird phrases. You know, nobody wants to hear about Latinx. Nobody wants to hear about criminal justice reform, defund the police. I mean, just the whole mess of the last 4 years. All the scolding. The scolding has to stop. The lecturing has to stop. That people really hate this. I mean, they just don't want to deal with it. And I can tell you, you know, the mail vote has been talked a lot about. Most guys really can't stand this. You know, they want to go back to 2019 so bad, pre-pandemic, you know, the George Floyd riots, pre all this you know, social unrest, where you know, it's a lot of guys constantly being told what, that they're toxic. You know, they're part of the patriarchy.
Mm.
I mean, enough already. You know, once you have a lot of people shutting down, you're not going to sell them on a candidate.
What do you make of where Governor Newsom goes from here? Because he this week saying he's going to be doing a special session, bringing the legislature back to try to fund lawsuits potentially against Donald Trump. What do you make of that?
Boy, he's trapped in 2022. I mean, he really is. That's not the mood of the country. That's not the mood of California. Tomorrow, it's very likely that the California Air Resources Board, or actually today, is going to raise gas prices 45, 55, 60% with this new fuel carbon standard. That's what he should be talking about. He should be having a special legislative session to stop CARB from raising the gas prices by 65 cents. That totally misreads what's going on here. People, all the stuff, we've got all that homeless, we've got all the crime, we've got the highest taxes, gas prices already almost at $5, and he's going to jack it up more? And he wants to sue Trump over what? When? Hey, Trump's not even president yet. He hasn't done anything yet. It's astonishing how tone deaf he is.
I mean, it seems like Governor Newsom has been ahead of the public for so much of his career on issues like same-sex marriage. But on Prop 36 and the crime issue, he was behind the public. And on this, he may be behind the public, too. It seems like the mood of the country right now is exhaustion.
Yes.
That people want a break. And you don't see the riots in the streets the way that you did after Trump beat Hillary Clinton the first time. The reaction of the public is very different. And I wonder if Newsom is off in his antenna in terms of where the people of California are right now.
He thinks there's going to be a sequel to the Great Resistance. There's not going to be. Because people don't have the energy for it. Right after Trump won, because we were in Washington inauguration week, and we ran across the Million Woman March. Remember all the pink hats they were wearing? Mm-hmm. There's not going to be another one like that. There's not going to be anything. People are more resigned. It's like, okay, we lost this time. This is the way it's going to go.
Yeah.
And there's, I think people realize there's nothing you can do about it.
As a Star Trek The Next Generation guy, I was amazed that there was a headline that I saw that said, "The resistance is futile." Which is, we'll see, though. Maybe there'll be a different kind of resistance or a different kind of Democratic Party in the years ahead.
He's capable of doing something so incendiary that it could stir up resistance, but not
Seems
now.
Like the best way to run for president would be to be a really good governor and deal with some of the issues that are here. We want to get to know you a little bit better because you're here, and let's have some fun with our personal issues game, which I know you love talking about.
Sure.
So this is the first thing that comes to mind to get to know you a little bit better. What is your favorite TV show you've watched recently?
You always do that with the TV shows. Knowing that I don't watch, I watch old TV shows.
You could say the issue is. That's
the
fine.
Issue is, sure.
There we go. Favorite book you've read recently?
I'm reading a book that's actually from 1984 called Class. Where this professor, I think he was from Rutgers, brutally described the habits and the interests of people depending on class.
Okay.
And boy, a lot of this stuff wouldn't fly publicly in 2024.
What's your favorite talk show other than your own?
Favorite radio talk show? God, I don't listen to too many because I don't want other people's thoughts and style to get into my head. But I do like Bill Maher's Club Random podcast.
Okay, very nice. And last question, and she didn't tell me to do this, is your wife Deborah always right?
Yes. I have to go home. You don't.
All right, John. Our thanks to John Cobalt. We end with a brief conversation with Pete Aguilar, who is the chair of the House Democrats. He's oversaw a lot of these close congressional races, and we talked to him about what's still to come. Congressman Pete Aguilar is the chair of the House Democrats. Congressman, great to see you.
Good to see you, Alex.
So Speaker Johnson says, basically, we got this thing in the bag. We think that there's going to be a Republican majority. What say you?
Not so fast. I think clearly it was a tough night for Democrats, but House Democrats outperformed the top of the ticket. We had pickups in the state of New York. We had some amazing holds. We're still picking up seats. We're still hearing back now from states like Colorado that we are doing well, pickup opportunity in Oregon. We're still counting ballots out here in the West in California and Arizona.
We know there's like five or six races in California that you all were super closely tracking. Getting into the nitty gritty, are you feeling especially good about a particular race?
Yeah, look, we think that among the trend lines we saw last night alone, we netted votes in the Dave Minn race, Derek Tran race, and George Whitesides. In those three races, we actually shrunk the Republican lead. That's very big for us. That's a good trend line. We anticipate that that will continue through today and tomorrow.
And you didn't mention the name Will Rollins. Are you concerned about him?
Yeah, in that race, he did take a step back, so we're keeping an eye on it. It is a race that's on the board. It is a race that got a lot of attention and support from us, and we're going to continue to keep an eye on it and watch those results in Riverside County in the evening.
Based off of what you're seeing, and you know this stuff better than just about anyone, are you tracking right now like a 1 or 2 seat difference? What do you think it's going to ultimately come down to?
The weather forecast is tight. That's what it is. Look, we're not in a position to say what the majority will be, but we are in a position to say the majority is not certain for either party right now. And so I think that much is clear. In California, we believe in counting every ballot and every vote. We feel good about where we are. It was a tough night, but we've always said that the House majority comes through California. We were living up to that right now.
Let's talk about that tough night. Donald Trump winning every single battleground state, doing better in California than he has done before. Why do you think that is?
Clearly, it was a tough night. I think I don't think you can minimize the economic anxiety that people have. The fact that inflation played a role over the past few years worldwide, but how elected officials across the globe have not done well because of those inflation concerns. We need to talk about the economic anxieties that people feel and the uncertainty that they feel, especially here in Southern California, where for many of us, that economic anxiety translates to higher grocery costs, higher gas prices, higher rents and housing affordability crisis that we're in. Those are things that people feel. And if they don't think that their leaders are doing enough to fix that, then that's going to be a problem.
So we will keep track of what's happening with all of those races in the days ahead. Next week on The Issue Is, a conversation with Adam Schiff, the new senator-elect from California. Thanks so much for watching this week. I'm Alex Michelson. We hope you'll like us, subscribe, tell people about it, share it out. And I'd love to hear from you in social media if you have any thoughts. See you next time for more The Issue Is.